Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's March 13th, 2015. You're listening to the best poker cast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And what could go wrong, right? Friday the 13th.
Wow. You know, I totally forgot about that.
Oh, man. Were you crazy? That's why we tape on Thursday. So
Because I'm so focused on the fact that I'm going to see Dawkins tonight.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Is that awesome?
Just don't lie to me. I love them.
Dream Warriors.
Under Lock and Key, man. That was like the greatest album. That was like the theme music of my teenage years.
Absolutely.
I wore that tape down, man.
Yeah.
That was before I even had CDs. I had tapes then when I was listening to them.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I don't think I ever had CDs at the good bands.
Oh, man, I have them now. Because, you know, as in like, you know, recollection kind of thing. But I got their disc here somewhere. I know I do. Wow, man, you're going to see Dawkins. Let's spend the whole show on Dawkins.
We could, couldn't we?
There's a K in Dawkins.
I've been told, because, you know, I go to all these hair metal festivals, right? So I'm part of all this underground, you know, kind of forum kind of thing, you know, kind of like what we have for poker, except it's for freaks for rock instead of freaks for poker, right?
Right.
And they're all like, oh, Don Dawkins can't sing anymore. So depressing. Which is the same thing they say about Vince Neil, and Vince Neil can't sing, but... So I'm a little worried. I'm a little worried going into this that it can't. And then I'm going to see him again next month at the big festival again.
Wow, year, so. Twice in like a month.
Yeah,
I've never seen him live. I just always loved that album. That Hairband album was just that Lock and Key album, man. I could just,
classic.
Oh man, I love that. I can't believe you and I actually agree on some music finally.
I know, it's crazy. Absolutely.
I mean, I don't listen to him now because I've grown up. But I mean, you know, but I still love them.
You just watch, you know, superhero movies, right?
Oh man, that was a low blow. Freaking making $1 billion in the theater, but I'm the only one. Apparently, I'm going like, you know, a million times myself.
Oh, love it. I guess we should talk about poker at some point.
I guess. Go ahead.
The talking rules. all right. So, not a lot of news going on this week, but I did see this. Mike Sexton, who obviously is the one of the faces of the World Poker Tour, took to his blog last week to lament some decisions that the World Series of Poker has made, including the November 9 delay, the number of bracelets being awarded, and that other worldwide events factor into the Player of the Year race. WSOP Executive Director Ty Stewart did a pretty lengthy response to the claims. So we got two opposing views here. Whose side are you on?
Here's the deal. Is it the World Poker Tour Mike Sexton saying it, or is it the old school Mike Sexton saying it? Is he saying it because he just wants to help his own tour look good? Or is he saying because he's an old school player, which he is, and he's thinking like an old school player? Which way does he really feel? That's the
interesting
thing.
Question. I would say, from my reading, I did not get a hint of competitiveness in the post. I mean, I think he did go out of his way to say that he, you know, he loves the World Series, loves being part of it. He, you know, he does have a bracelet, just his concern, and I guess his overarching concern is that he thinks that all these changes have been made in the name of green paper.
Yeah, and then for that, then I'm probably on Mike Sexton's side in this argument. Now I could be on both sides because hey, if you're the World Series, you want to do everything you can to promote your brand and squash every other little tour like the Ante Up Poker Tour or something, you know, because you don't want any competitors. But at the same time, when is it so saturated that you're tired of seeing it? I mean, you see it all the time with television stars, you know, you see them everywhere in all these commercials and everything. All of a sudden, you're just tired of hearing their voices, and you don't watch the show anymore because you're tired of them. Right. Same thing with this kind of thing. I mean, how much is too much? I mean, 67, pretty soon it's going to be 70 bracelets, and it's going to be, you know, you can win a circuit ring, you know, 12 times in 1 week. So, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, 30 stops for the circuit ring, and then when's it going to be too much? When you know what I mean? There's only so much money to go around for these players. Unless they start putting in money to these tournaments.
Interesting.
You know, to me, I think I have to side with Mike Sexton on this, just because, again, the November 9 delay to me was cool in the beginning, but it's beyond that now. It's not cool anymore. It's just sort of old to me. I mean, I like the idea. I get the idea. But the original reason they did it, and I know we talk about this all the time, I don't care, but the fact that, you know, they were trying to line it up with the ESPN coverage.
Right.
So that the way ESPN did it when it got to that final table actually meant something. And I'm sure that's what sparked the idea. But then they're like, well, yeah, but then we'll have 3 months to build it up. But you know what? It's just 3 months for us to forget about it now, to me, it seems like. Because not everybody's watching. I mean, I know the numbers are pretty decent on ESPN still, but it's not like they were in the heyday. So, yeah, the November 9, I think, I don't agree with the delay anymore. I think, okay, it was cool. It was not a publicity stunt. I wouldn't call it a stunt. It was an experiment. Yeah.
Right.
And it was kind of cool the first couple of years, but now it's like, hey, you know, whatever. I mean, I can hardly remember who won the tournament anymore now. Never mind who the 9 guys were, you know what I mean?
Well, and I don't think that changes whether you finish it out in July.
You're probably right. But the reason they did it was so you get to know those 9 people, and you still don't know them, right? Say back in their hometown.
I would say the specific point that Mike made about this was that and this is where you hear a lot of his comments coming from the pro side of it rather than the amateur side of it. And to me, the World Series Poker is always going to be about amateurs. You know, it's the biggest event in our sport, and it's the only sport where a rank amateur can just show up and play.
Right.
That's what makes it so cool, I think. So I do get a little bothered when I see pros saying, hey, this isn't working out for the pros, you know.
Right.
But his point was, you know, hey, you're at your top of the game in July, and then all of a sudden the tournament stops, and then all the other 8 people at the table that may not be at the top of their game right now have 3 months to improve their game and come back, and it's a different tournament now.
Right. You're absolutely right. That's 100%
compelling argument.
Right. Think about it. Just here's how I always think of things these days. Translate it to something else and see how that would go. Okay, we've watched the U.S. Open in bowling or whatever. We've watched U.S. Open in tennis for 2 weeks. Get down to the final. Now we're going to give these guys 3 months to think about how to play against their opponent. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it. Give a baseball team 3 months to prepare for the World Series. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I understand. And then on top of it, like you said, these guys can improve dramatically and change it dramatically. And they can, like you saw, I'm sure you've seen the videos of these guys training for it, where they're playing they're playing these sit and goes with the identical stacks and playing out all these scenarios. And it's just not the same tournament anymore. They're different players 3 months later because they're preparing for that specific moment, whereas they don't know how to prepare for it or what that specific moment's going to be if they're playing it in the moment. Live the next day or something, and it's just not. You're just changing the tournament. It's just not. It's almost impossible to think that the guy who won it after November 9 would have been the guy who would have won it had they kept playing the next day and been exhausted and not knew anything about anybody and all that. So to me, you're changing. It's like the cards of destiny. You know what I mean? You're not doing what was meant to be done. And it's completely different. It kind of reminds me when they screwed up with but when they did the Players' Championship and they were changing all the games, and then when it finally got the TV, they keep it No Limit Hold'em.
Right,
so
what are
you proving then? I mean, what are you... You're changing the entire game. It's like play stud for 12 hours, and then at the 13th hour, we're going to go to Badoogie. What? And you don't do that. So, I don't know. I mean, obviously, you can literally argue. This is one of those debate class topics that you could take either side and defend. So
yeah, oh, absolutely, I could defend either one. I mean, I think Todd made a good point about the November 9 in the sense that no one wants to watch a 3-month-old tournament on TV,
right?
And this is a way of getting it fresh. I mean, it's really almost in real time, as close as you can get for a poker tournament. And that builds excitement, which obviously does help the sport overall, right? Mm-hmm. And if you just go back to the old way where you're 3 months after the tournament, there's no drama, right? You know who won, so now you're just watching it to watch it, which, you know, there are some people out there that just enjoy watching poker and will love that. But for most people, it's the almost live part of it that's rejuvenated TV.
I agree with that. Right. But, you know, there are, if people really want to watch that TV show and not know who won, they could. I mean, I went years without knowing who won the main event until our magazine got so important and whatever that we had to, you know, put it in the magazine and know who won. So,
right.
But I did go a long time without knowing. So if you don't really want to know, unless you're in the industry, you could not know.
Good. Right.
You know, and even if you did know, it's still
very
exciting to see it. But, yeah, I know.
I mean, I binge watched House of Cards because I didn't want anybody to spoil any of the 13 episodes, you know, on Facebook. So it's a different world now.
But, yeah.
Now, he did talk about the number of bracelets, and I know, a lot, I guess all three of these things are kind of tired topics, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because we've talked about this before, too. And, I can see on one side of it, you see the profit motive for the Caesars to, you know, hey, the more bracelet events we have, the more people are going to come pack the Rio. I don't have any problem with that at all, to be honest. And, again, this is kind of the pro lament, you know, hey, you know, it needs to be special. And, Ty's response was, you know, hey, we've got a number of 10,000K buy-in championship events that appeal to those kind of people. Those are still special because there's a barrier to entry, right?
Right.
Your normal amateur is not going to plunk down $10,000 several times, right?
Right.
So you still have some, you know, value there. And I guess my argument would be the special is still the main event, right?
Uh-huh.
There's only one main event every year. And there's only one world champion every year. And that's always going to be the case no matter what happens. So, and if you ask any poker player, I gotta think, and maybe I'm wrong, which tournament do you want to win during the year? It's that one, right?
Sure.
So, you know, the fact that there's 69 other bracelet events and you win a bracelet, that's great. You're never going to be able to devalue the main event world championship.
I agree. I mean, I can't disagree with that.
And the fact that you have these other bracelets, it encourages more people to want to play. You know, I mean, really, what's, you know, so there's 70 bracelets this year or however many more if you add the ones around the world that count now as bracelets.
Right.
It's still a pretty small number of people, right?
Yeah, it's just
overall?
Less precious. I mean, it's less precious.
I mean, it's not like they're giving away 400 bracelets.
Right.
You know, hey, I won the 11 a.m. No Limit Hold'em tournament. And then did it back-to-back in the 1 p.m. You know, I guess there's a point. Everybody has their own range of when that point is crossed. There's too many, and Mike obviously is at that point now. I'm not. I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be a lot more than 70 a year before I join that argument, I think.
Well, I can see. And here's the deal, too. If you think about it, when these, especially these old-time pros, you know, when they were winning bracelets back in the day, the amount of poker players was exponentially smaller.
Right.
So if you only had 10 bracelets given out in 1 year, that's the equivalent of, you know, and actually it hasn't even caught up properly when you think about the, now that you have 7,000 guys entering the main event,
right,
when you used to have 10, you know, and got to 100, think about that, you know, there should be 700 bracelets a year when you think about how many people play poker now versus how many people play poker in the 70s and 80s. So I guess there's that argument too.
Well, I think you could also make the argument that bracelets are harder to win now. There's more of them, but they're harder to win, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, back in the 70s, I mean, what, 20, 30 people in a tournament?
Exactly.
Win a bracelet?
Exactly.
You know, I don't care if those other 19 people are the best players in the world. It's still easier to win a 20-player tournament than it is to win a 1,500-player tournament.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that they probably do weigh each other out. I mean, there is the preciousness of the amount of bracelets out there that makes you think 70, oh my God, it's so many of them, you know, or 67, whatever it really is. But that is a lot. I'm just saying, considering, because there's only one World Series in baseball trophy a year.
Right.
You know, I mean, and they've increased the teams from whatever it was in the old days, 10, 12, whatever, 8, whatever. So, I mean, they keep increasing teams and players and rosters, but they don't increase how many championships you get. Now, they do increase division championships, but those aren't real championships. You know what I mean? You win your division, it doesn't mean anything. While other things have grown in popularity, most of the time it's still just one thing, and I guess that's get back to your main event thing. You know, and I don't really know. There's not very much that you can compare this to that are similar. You know, there aren't very other... I mean, how many other sports or hobbies or whatever you want to call these activities or athletics, whatever you want to call them, how many of them are like this, where you have all these different disciplines where you could be crowned a champion? You know, like in darts, there's, you know, 301 and 501 and cricket or whatever and all these. But, I mean, there aren't a lot of things that translate like poker, where there's all these...
Yeah, it's kind of like swimming in the Olympics, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody gets 7 gold medals in swimming, but, you know.
Yeah,
only exactly. One soccer medal, it's always...
It's weird.
Burns my toes.
Yeah, it's weird. You can just be part of a 4-man relay.
Yeah, that's right.
I could be part of that 4-man relay if you give me, you know, those guys. But, you know, it's just remarkable. It's just a unique industry that we have. So it's hard to really blame them for putting that many events. It's just remarkable how many of there are now. You know, yeah, and you're right, though. It is difficult. There are thousands entering these events every time, not hundreds or even dozens. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, and this first tournament this year is going to be, what, 10, 15,000, they think?
Oh, man.
More than that. You know, that's amazing.
It's amazing. So,
well, then his last point was about the, and this is where he deviates from my argument that he's talking from a pro's perspective. He actually goes the opposite way. With the adding the worldwide events in. And I gotta say, this kind of rubbed me the wrong way when they started doing that.
Yeah.
But, you know, since then, I'm like, you know, hey, this is a world series of poker, right?
Mm-hmm.
It should reflect the events around the world. That's part of it. And, I mean, maybe there's a secondary prize for the person that's does well just in Vegas every year, you know. Because there is something cool about a player just getting hot. And every year there's a player just gets hot, right?
Yeah.
And wins 2 or 3 bracelets or makes 6 final tables or something that's mind-boggling. But I guess here's the other thing is, you know, how many awards do we need? How much, you know, patting on the back do we need to do for people?
You mean like the American Poker Awards? We just touted for the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks.
Well, that's a little different because that's more opinion based rather than
right.
You know, performance based. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, everybody likes to be recognized. Don't get me wrong, but you know, does it really matter whether you're the player of the year or you're not the player of the year because you had a great run at the Rio but didn't have the money to fly to? Across the pond, which is what Mike's saying, and, you know, there's a very finite amount of people that have the resources, poker players that have resources to actually travel enough to actually win this award. Or can you not just be happy with all the money and the bracelets that you won?
That's the first thing I thought of was the fact that it's hard if you want to be player of the year and get the endorsements from it or get the accolade of it or whatever. It's you know, you got to try to play all the events, and it is hard to do it. It's hard to do it locally. It's hard to do it, you know, domestically or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So to actually have to go to wherever the WSOPE is and all these other things, that's difficult. Here's the deal. My problem is with the naming of the event in the first place.
Mm.
You know, the fact that they just thought it was cute to call it the World Series of Poker back in 1970 or whatever.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
That to me is just like the World Series in baseball. It's ridiculous because, you know, you're just literally now saying, hey, if you're going to call it the World Series, you got to let worldwide events contribute to it. Well, they certainly don't have the Pan Am Games part of the World Series qualification in baseball. They don't have the Japan League part of it. You know what I mean? They don't. They just had the balls and the gall to say, we're going to call this the World Series because we invented baseball and whatever in their minds. So... To me, same thing with poker. Well, they thought, oh, well, we're the best in the world and whatever, so we're going to call it the World Series, call ourselves world champions and give us egos the size of the 10-gallon hats we're wearing. And so to me, I would say, hey, you name it the World Series of Poker. Some of these other places now, the game is catching up to you, so you either...
Should be a World Series.
That's right. You either include it or you call them the National Player of the Year for the World Series here.
Oh, there's an excellent idea. See, and then you're solving problems.
World player of the year. Yeah, so there you go. We're solving problems. That's what we do here at Antio. But I agree with you. But it all starts with the balls on them to name it the World Series in the first place. It's huge.
Just catching up to their nuts.
Yeah, that's right. So I think ultimately I agree with Mike Sexton, but I could argue both sides of it.
Yeah, this is an easy one. You're right. If the debate teacher gives you a card, I could hammer pretty hard on
you. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting to talk about it.
Cool, yeah.
All right. Well, I think this is going to be interesting, too. A longtime listener and frequent contributor, Jason Grimes, sent us a list of etiquette questions not too long ago. And he was very clear in this that not to focus individually on each of the three questions he's giving. It's just more of a discussion on where we are with etiquette in poker. Now, obviously, we're just going to blow that up. We're just going to talk about the questions, right? So, right. Sorry, Jason. But hopefully people can take the comments and weave together a tapestry of etiquette from our conversation. So, okay. The first one, he says, when a player requests to know how many chips another player has remaining, the responses I heard have ranged from okay to why to just icy stares. Is there something wrong with asking this question?
No. Okay, next one. I know why people get aggravated at it, because they're trying to get a tell out of you. They're just trying to delay the game. And people that's what people think. They think that, you know, you're just wasting our time, or you're trying to see if I'm going to do something, and you're trying to get more information out of me somehow. And so a lot of people don't want to succumb to that. You know, some people just want to keep that, you know, that Helmuth perch or the Navarro perch or whatever you want to call it, and don't want to move. And they want to just sit there. So when somebody makes you break from character or whatever it is you're doing, you kind of get aggravated with it. So I can see why they get mad. But no, there's nothing wrong with asking that question. Ultimately, though, if you want an answer to it and the guy's not giving it to you, the dealer will be the one that will count down the chips for you. You don't have to do anything as a player getting that question to you. So
yeah, I think this is one of those things where it's all in how you phrase the question. Yeah. You know, if you say, hey, man, how many chips do you have? Then it's off-putting. It's not, you know, it's like, oh, you know, whatever. Not everybody's going to answer you, but it doesn't seem like being a Deutsche Bank, right?
Right.
Where there are players that, like, they phrase that question very Deutsche Bank-ish, right?
Yeah.
And that's where people get upset, I think. Now, perhaps your goal in asking the question is to get the person riled up. In that case, you know, being a Deutsche Bank fits your game, but... but I think that's where it comes down. It's just it's how you ask it. So if people were out there out, hey, you know, I feel bad, I'm just asking. And I had to edit down some of this too. I think this is what Jason's point was. You know, hey, I'm not trying to get an angle on you or ruffle your feathers. I need to know how many chips you have, and so I can do my mathematical calculations, right? So it seems like an honest question, and then I'm getting all this, you know, ruffled feathers back, and then why?
I think people who are upset by the question is because if you truly are just trying to find a number to do your math, just ask the dealer. Dealer, can you count it down for me? Can you tell me what he has?
Well, that's the way if it's all – the bet's been made, though. I mean, if you're just asking in general, then you can't get that information.
Oh, okay. Is he asking in general or in a hand is what I'm – I thought it was always
a general question, so yeah. But I mean, there's two scenarios that you're talking about. Okay. One you can do what you're talking about. The other one you can't. So
okay, I was thinking that it's always in the
you
hand.
You probably get a different answer or response either way. You know,
right.
If I've shoved all in at that point, I mean, really, what does it cost me to tell someone how many chips I have? You know,
the word that gets me is in his sentence is remaining, meaning like
that's true.
He's put some out, so there's a bet. That's the one he's asking, because you wouldn't just randomly ask a guy, hey, how many chips you got. I would never do that. I would never just randomly.
Yeah, I think a lot of players do actually. I
mean, I've never.
They want to know, you know. You know, usually it's when you make a pretty big bet, and they have you covered, and they want to know, you know, whether it's worth them to fade it if they lose.
Right. No, I mean, I'm saying not in a hand. If somebody's made a bet and you're going up against another player, yeah, you ask them something, but that means a bet's been made somewhere.
Right. Exactly.
But I mean,
not just the beginning of the hand.
Yeah. Right? So whenever a bet has been made and you want to know how many chips, as long as that person's made the bet, you can ask the dealer to tell how many chips.
Oh yeah, yeah, so, the bet, yeah, but not the chips.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, and then I think you can even say, "Can I get a count, please?" And the dealer has to count your chips. I mean, I'm fairly certain.
Well, again, right? Depending on whether they've been wagered yet or not.
Right.
They haven't been wagered. No,
right.
I mean, it gets to the whole thing. I mean, you have to be, the players are required to have their chips stacked neatly. And
so you can see them.
And all that. Right. So it should be so you are able to actually count the chips yourself you know, assuming you know how to count. Right. And so those are the kind of things that you're kind of required as an opponent to be given, but, you know, no one's going to count the chips for you.
Well, right,
you
it's the all-ins that the dealer
right.
would
count
it for you.
Right, you've got to be reasonably... You know, you can't be hiding your chips behind napkins, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And only when you're all in, then the dealer will count it down for you. But it is weird how much you got left and then somebody giving you crap for it. But I still have to answer. You don't have to say anything, so...
All right, this next one's interesting. I've been wanting to talk to you about this, so I'm interested in what you think. So it says, what do you think of crude language at the table? Not language that directly harms or is directed at a player or dealer or staff, but just crude language in the presence of women who are at the table, or just a constant use of cursing or suggestive language.
I unless everyone that is at that table that I know and they're all doing it themselves and they're all comfortable with it, and I've seen in the past a history of them doing it themselves and not being offended by it. Other than that, I hate it. Mm-hmm. I absolutely hate it. It kills me. Like, even in other walks of life, like I'll walk into a store or something and I'll hear the clerk behind the thing drop an F-bomb, and I'm thinking there's women in this, you know, standing behind me, or even, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a woman. It has nothing to do with it. We should all be treated this way. It's not right. I mean, I don't think it's right. I mean, you can't say, I mean, there are legal things too. If you're in public and you're using vulgar language, I think you can get in trouble. So why is it any different if you're in a public setting in a poker room? I've always been against vulgar language. If I'm with my friends and we're in the home game, we all swear in the home game because we all know each other's personalities and we all don't care. And so we swear because it's funnier. But, I mean, at a poker table in public, when I don't know those people and there's people behind me I don't know who can hear me and people next to me I don't know, I never, ever swear at a poker table in public, ever. Unless, you know, I'm in a conversation with you joking around on the side or something. But publicly, crude language like that, it makes me shiver. I hate it.
Yeah, I think there's got to be a baseline set, you know. I mean, obviously, I swear like a sailor, but only where I believe that it's acceptable for me to do it. Yeah. You know, home game or at a bar or friends and stuff like that, you know. I'm not going to swear in the shopping mall, you know, right. Or like that. Or at a table where I don't know anywhere. I'm not, and for the most part, when you're playing poker, unless it's a home game, you don't know the people around you. So until, you know, I get a sense that people are more comfortable with. Even that, I don't think I even really swear that much at all in a real poker room. Just because, you know, even if you're at the table, there's other tables around you, right?
Right.
Or things like that. It just doesn't seem the proper place. But what I thought was interesting, though, was his mention of in presence of women. And this is what I wanted to ask you about, because this is an interesting conversation you and I had a long time ago. I never really followed up with the audit because it's not that big a deal. But since you brought it up now, I remember one time you were telling me how you went out, you and Jeannie went out with another couple, and you were horrified that the gentleman started swearing in front of a woman that he hasn't met. And I always thought that was odd, because I'm like, what the heck, does it matter if it's a woman or not? You know, Laura swears more than I do. And you're not going to offend her. So I wonder if a lot of it comes with you know, where we were raised, how we were raised, or something like that. And that's not right or wrong or anything. I wonder if it's just a kind of a cultural thing.
I don't know.
Women versus the general public. Well, I mean, you already qualified this in the beginning of this conversation. It doesn't really matter, but...
It doesn't. I mean, I think you just shouldn't be that way until you're comfortable with them. But then again, how do you find out if you're comfortable with them until they actually drop that first
exactly.
F-bomb in front of you?
It's a chicken and egg. Right?
Yeah, it is a chicken and egg. But I always just...
But there are ways. There's ways I try to probe, you know. You know, I don't go the F-bomb right away, but I might go, gateway curse word.
Gateway.
And then always explain excuse my language. And then when they're like, forget it, I swear all the time. I'm like, awesome!
Yeah.
F-bomb the rest of
the
night.
Yeah, and you can't do that at a poker table.
That's right, yeah. Because it's not dinner with friends.
But it is interesting. I never swear in front of somebody I don't know until it's obvious that I know them and they know me and we know each other's personalities and I know they'll accept it. Or sometimes I wait for somebody else to make the faux pas and then wait for that person to go, oh, don't worry about it. And, oh, okay, cool. F this, F that, you know? I mean, it makes me so uncomfortable. Like, I would never go into a meeting with one of our poker room managers for the first time and then just stop dropping F-bombs unless he does first. That's my protocol. If they drop one first, then I'll drop one. Otherwise,
all right, so here's the other, we'll move on here after this, but this is the other thing that I think is kind of interesting is context and where you are. You know, I mentioned that if I'm at a bar, I don't feel like if it's not a Chuck E. Cheese, you know, obviously, right. But, you know, in a bar where you have to be 21 to be in, it's like that. You know, I think there's some kind of, understanding that you're in an adult establishment and adult things are going to happen, right?
Yeah.
And doesn't gambling and poker kind of fit into that to some degree? And I'm not suggesting that people just wander around dropping F-bombs in the poker room, but I could see someone getting offended when you say I'm offended.
Well, here's the deal.
Hey, what are you doing in a gambling hall then if you don't like horse language?
Okay, I would agree to that to a point. And the point being, in poker, there are rules and etiquette. In the bar, there are rules in the sense that, hey, yeah, we can freaking, you know, expect you not to stab the guy sitting next to you, or expect him not to whatever it is you do in a bar where you get thrown out if you do it. But I mean, we're talking about rules in place for tournaments, rules put in place for how you treat, you know, people and stacks, and you get penalties, and this is a regulated environment. Well, and it's meant to a family, not family environment, but it's meant to be entertainment where you can go and expect people to protect you and whatever. But in a bar or wherever, I don't know where other adult things you can come up with, but I mean, to me, the only rule that's stopping you there is public drunkenness and and whatever laws.
Public drunkenness doesn't stop you from doing anything.
Well, no, but there are laws against certain things that you could do, and even those things can't be violated or you're in trouble. So to me, I would think that, yeah, you might be able to get away with saying whatever you want in a bar, but if you get unruly with what you're saying, they'll still throw you out.
Right. So, yeah, I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It is how you're raised. I think it's your personal way of dealing with things. It's like an understood rule in my head that I never swear in front of somebody I don't know until I hear them swear first, or I hear someone else swear in front of them and they're not blanched by it or whatever. You know what I mean? Then I might occasionally drop in the gateway swear or something, but I would never, ever, ever drop an F-bomb in front of someone I don't know. Especially a woman. I don't know why that. I shouldn't say it like that, but I've always been raised to be nice.
You know, it's
that way.
A cultural thing.
Yeah,
fine. It's just interesting. But all right. So finally, he says, "What about the balancing act between staying out of how a hand proceeds in which you are not a material player, versus the rule I've seen in every poker room that says it's the player's responsibility to help ensure that the correct result of a hand occurs? For example, if a player shows a third person their hand and is about to muck what is the winning hand face down, is there any responsibility for the third person to point out that they had the winning hand, or should they remain silent?"
Okay, well, now I don't think this is etiquette anymore. Because etiquette isn't exactly fixed in rules.
It's a guide. It's not...
Right, it's exactly. It's just how you feel about something, and do we all feel the same way about something. But in this situation, you have you're accepting the responsibilities of the rules of the room by entering that room and playing them. And if you don't follow the rules, then you can be expected to leave or thrown out. So in this case, if the rule is every person is supposed to hold up the respectability of the game, and if the winning hand is there, you need to point it out, then doing it is following the rules. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's not etiquette. I would say it's just following the rules. Am I wrong on that?
No, exactly. I think it's probably a weird trying to navigate to the rules, because I think it's probably misreading the rules. The rule is intended to make sure that play is done properly and you're protecting all players. But if a player wants to muck his hand, there's no responsibility on your part to tell him not to muck it.
Yeah.
You know, that's up to him. Now, the difference is when he just throws that hand face up and no one sees the flush and you do and you don't say anything, now that's a problem. That's when you need to be pointing it out. But, you know, a person's got to take personal responsibility for themselves to the table. So, you know, you're not going to be ever in a poker room where someone says, "Hey, didn't you see that guy's hand before he mucked face down? Why didn't you say anything?"
Yeah, I mean,
it's not going to happen. So.
Cards speak, right? I mean, that's right. The way he puts them up, and then you're fine to say something. It seems weird, though, if you and I were sitting next to each other at a poker table and we were playing in a cash game and there were four hearts on board and you didn't pick up on that and you're like, "Look at this, I had ace king to start," and you had the ace of hearts in your hand and you're like, you're getting ready to fold, I'd be like, "Dude, you got enough flush. I mean, I would say it. I don't know why I would, but I would. I would say
see,
it.
And that's wrong, too, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's right as a friend, but it's wrong as a poker player, right?
I guess.
And then, of course, what do you do if you don't? I mean, if you let me mock it, and then you're like, dude, man, I couldn't say anything, but you threw the flush away. Then I'm going to pretend to beat you up, and you're going to beat me up because you're bigger than me.
But, but I mean, really,
so,
that's...
You know, so, I mean, what do you do at that point? Do you just, like, let me mock it and not say? And then, like, 20 years later on the podcast, you remember, oh, I got to tell you, it's been beat that way for 20 years. You threw that flush away.
Well, I got something to tell you now, then. No. But really, yeah, that is a fine line there. So maybe this is falling back into etiquette now. You know,
well,
I guess you
pieces
don't
of
say
it are. I think.
Yeah, I guess you
pieces
don't say anything with that.
And I think he was just kind of blending the rules with the etiquette there. And I think the more you're able to separate the two, the easier it is to come up with the right thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's poker, so it's not always easy to come up with the right thing to do. All
right, well, continuing on with the listener portion of the show. Each week we spot a listener who has called our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emailed us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something cool. This week's sponsor is J-Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. This comes from Chappy Poker, and it's a hotline, which we don't usually get very often, so let's listen.
Hey guys, this is Chappy Joker from Indianapolis, Indiana. Long-time listener, but I got away from the podcast for like 2 or 3 years and just got my iPhone 6 Plus and got back on the podcast to see that you guys were still doing shows, and that is awesome. I've been going back and listening from the current all the way back. I've been listening on. I'm a postman. So I listen to the shows on my route, and it is incredible. I am just happy that you guys are still doing it and doing it at a high level, the hands of the day, everything. I called in May 8th of 2009. You guys put me on your show, the Grand episode. I was just happy to see you guys still doing it and still doing it strong. And just telling you guys what a great job you guys do for poker. And again, just want to say thanks and listening to all the shows that I missed. So keep up the good work, and glad that you guys are still doing what you're doing. Thanks.
Aw, shugs.
Every once in a while, we got to put one of these on.
Yeah, I always like when they find the show again, and oh my gosh, you're still doing it, then, you know, and brought joy to people's lives, you know, that's great. So, and I'll say this too, my father, his entire career was in the U.S. Postal Service, so I have a lot of respect for the men and women who deliver rain or sleet or snow. And I get a little defensive about it too, because, you know, every time the price of stamps go up.
I know.
All the bellyache. Oh my gosh.
I know.
47 cents for a stamp. When's it going to end? And I'm like, 47 cents to take this letter from Florida and send it to California.
I know.
How is that a bad deal?
I know.
It's the best deal in the world. It should be $1.50.
Yeah, but anyhow, I've always been that way. And, you know, they got the forever stamps now and everything. And it's like, really? Really, you can't afford to pay the extra 6 cents the 2 or 3 times a year you mail something. You know, I mean, we as a business we mail a lot of stuff, but I mean, as a you know, as an individual person in the private sector, really, 48 cents is gonna kill you.
I go to the post office once a month to deliver all our bills and stuff, and it's mind-boggling to see the idiocy of people.
Oh man,
just in this age now where everything's electronic and email. How do I put a stamp on an envelope? And I'm not even making that up. I heard that once. Gotta be kidding. But anyhow, thanks for listening. We appreciate the kind words.
Yes, thank you very much. All right, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been. Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and we'll have Golden Nugget Las Vegas poker director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This week's sponsor is PokerRadius.com, poker's newest social networking site and home of the Antiup group discussions. Comes from Greg. He says, in a home game tournament, action folds around the small blind who announces a raise. Before he puts in his raise, the big blind pushes all in. As the dealer, I have him pull it back so the small blind can complete his action. The small blind places a min raise and the big blind tries to fold. Not having run into this before, I told him he was responsible for at least the raise. No one really knew how to deal with this. Action didn't really change since he knew that a raise was coming. Further discussion was that if he had folded before the small blind put in his raise, the fold would have stood. Therefore, following the same logic, the all-in should have stood.
All right, Sam says, the big blind's action is current, even though they didn't allow the small blind to complete the raise. I would enforce the all-in wager of the big blind after the completion of the mid-raise from the small blind.
Okay. That works for me.
Ah, yeah, I wish I had more to add to it, but...
That works for me.
You know, remember to act and turn, folks.
That's right, act and turn. Very easy.
And verbalize all your action, unless verbalizing all your action is going to cause you
problems. Acting and turn is easy. You know how you do it? You just act in turn. When it's your turn...
Especially the blind.
You
like, come on. You know, I get it. It's like, you know, some Yahoo in seat four folds and starts the chain reaction, you know, of people not paying attention, but... You're down to the small blind, the big blind.
Yeah.
You got one person left to watch. What else are you watching at that point?
Oh, man. Hey, we got the complete O'Malley's move today. Let's get to it.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're seated at a $2, $5 No Limit Hold'em Casino Cash Game. The table has been pretty predictable and is full of players who are mostly solid. We're up $10 as we sit with 5-10. We've been playing for about 3 hours. The blinds post, the under-the-gun calls, plus one folds, and we look down at the queen of spades, queen of clubs. This is a good starting hand that we are not going to get cute with. The table standard raise has been between 20 and 30, so we split the difference and make it $25 to go. It's folded around to the big blind who makes the call, and the under-the-gun folds. Of course, we get involved in a hand with the only calling station at the table. The big blind has been pretty loose at this table, sometimes turning over premium cards, but other times turning over garbage. He doesn't like to play big pots and gets noticeably uncomfortable when he feels the stakes are getting too high. He's been at the table since before we got here, but from what we've gathered has had to rebuy once. He started the hand with about 525. The flop is not the greatest flop in the world. The King of Hearts, 10 of Diamonds, Deuce of Diamonds comes down, but our opponent checks to us. I don't think he has a king, and if he doesn't, we're probably pretty far ahead, so we're going to value bet this flop. With about $50 in the pot, we make it $30 to go. The big blind calls. With about 110 in the pot, the turn is the 7 of clubs, and again our opponent checks to us. If he had a strong king, wouldn't he want to lead out eventually to get value for his hand? Maybe it's King Jack and he's concerned we've got him outkicked. The way it's come down, I don't think he's all that strong. Plus, even though he's loose, we've seen him fold hands here or there. I think another bet is in order. We decide to go a little more than half the pot. This bet is a 50-50 bet, half for value and half hoping to take it down now. Perhaps a little more would have been better. Once again, our opponent simply calls. I'm not crazy about the way he's played the hand, but I am glad that we have position on him. The river is another blank, the three of spades, and once again he checks to us. So, are we satisfied with the size of the pot? Could this be a situation where we have to bet to win? Or are we ahead and a value bet is in order? What's the move?
All right, this is a classic calling station behavior, I think. I think it's hard to put him on anything other than a king or a missed flush draw. If it's the former, we'll have to put in a pretty big bet to here to take it down, I think, right?
Yeah.
And since he's been described as scared of big pots, that might work. If it's the latter, he's not going to put another dollar in, so is it really worth the risk to us? In a tournament, I might look for the perfect size bet to push him off his king. But in a cash game, I rarely see the point in taking that risk. I'm going to check behind here with what I think is showdown value.
Yeah, you know, it sucks when we agree. We agreed on music today.
This is,
of course, I think we disagree on how to pronounce it. I think it's Dokken, not Dokken.
Well, it's also button, not baton.
That's true. So, anyway, there's no way I think I can bet here unless I really, really, really think this guy has only a weak king and is actually capable of folding to the right bet. I mean, I know you said he's afraid of scared, you know, scared of big pots or whatever, but if he's a calling station and he's got a king.
That's the point. You're talking about the right bet.
I know, it's right.
The hardest part here is the right bet, right? So if you got to go through all that effort to figure out the right bet, is it really worth it?
Is it worth the betting? And that's what I'm saying here is so many ifs in this situation that I just have to check and hope he was drawing or that I have a better hand than him at some point somehow. Like he gets 10 or something. I don't know. But, yeah, I don't think I can get up enough gumption to put in some money in this pot anymore. So let's just check behind. All right.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, let's see what he does.
Hello again. Something doesn't seem right with the way this guy played the hand. He called an early to mid-position raiser from the big blind, knowing he'd be playing the entire hand out of position to a possibly strong hand. Why so timid? Are we being walked? If he had some kind of strong king, wouldn't he have wanted to find out just how strong we were pre-flop? The more I thought about this, the more I went back to his image. This guy is loose and passive. And another thing, just because an overcard hits does not mean our opponent has it. I'm inclined to think we're good here. So the only question now is, what is his range? And based on that, what is the right amount that will get us maximum value for our queens? This could possibly be jacks, maybe some kind of 10, and he's hoping we have ace-queen. Either way, I think we're betting for value here. Let's hope he has a hand that he can call us with and not just a busted draw. With about 230 in the pot, we make a nice even $100 bet. Our opponent sighs and thinks for a while before uttering those beautiful words. I think you're just trying to buy it. He calls. We turn over our queens and our opponent mucks his cards. Wonder what he had. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying sometimes having the best hand is not enough. You need to get maximum value for it. I think we did here. I hope to see you on the felt.
Am I the only one who really, really wants to know what our opponent had here?
Really? What is it?
I mean, I'm guessing a 10, maybe? I mean, nothing else really makes sense. So I'll give kudos to O'Malley for getting more value out of this hand than I would have. I'm literally stunned right now.
Yeah, it'd be one thing if he folded, then you're like, oh, draw. But
yeah,
he called.
Exactly, yeah.
So
he must have thought he had something.
His 10 might have been, you know, he might have had a 10 and just didn't believe us. But really? I mean, it's not like we made, our own two pair on the river that beat his, like, 10 deuce or something, or 10-7. Right. I mean, we had queens. So you were thinking your 10s were good the whole way? So he's a classic calling station.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I was going to say, it goes back to calling station. You know, hey, I've got a piece of this, so I'm going to see it. Which I guess I kind of forgot. You know, I was thinking more about the trying to push him off this hand and the fact that he'd call a pretty big bet.
And the thing about it,
makes sense that he would just call if he had any piece of this.
You know, it's not a terrible move because he's a calling station and that seemed to be the characteristic that won out here, not the big pot thing. So, but what if he had check raised you? I mean, it would just one, not that.
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, then what do you do? Right? Yeah.
He's got to fold, right? There's no way your queen's going
to
be good.
It was brilliant to get that 100 out of there, but there's no way your queens are good, right? So, nice job, Mal. I don't know how you did it, buddy, but I will never put that 100 in there, and you did it, and
made us, the eye of the needle, right?
Made us look silly.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. Longtime listener David Bloomberg, our Survivor expert.
Yes, that's right.
I've been talking to him about the new season, which I think is phenomenal, by the way. But now we're back to poker, right?
Right.
So he says he's back in his weekly home game with the mostly old guys, I'm sorry, in quote, okay. Which really could be us or anybody else. But I think Dave's more our age, so these guys are probably truly old and not just perceived old like we are. Says he has about $410. He started with 200. Credits that the extra 210 to a couple big hands early. First to act, looks down at Jack of Spades, Jack of Diamonds. What does he do?
Oh, man. So I don't even know these people.
They're mostly old guys.
I'm expected to know what old guys means. Am I an old guy? I don't know.
It means something different for everyone.
I mean, I qualify for some senior events, but not others. So am I an old guy? How would I play against him? I don't know. So generally, I'm going to be ABC with this until I'm told otherwise. So I'll just I'll just raise it. I don't even know. What are the blinds? What are the...
That's
you know anything about this game?
I'm going to guess it's a 1-2 game. He doesn't say specifically. I think this might have been a hand of the week after another hand of the week, and it's just been a while since we obviously tried to get new hands of the week from new people.
Right. So let's say it's a 1-2 game, and we're going to make it the standard raise at the table. So I'm not going to give a number, but if there's
a standard
raise...
whatever the standard is.
Yeah, whatever that is, I'll make it. 10, 12, 6, whatever. Whatever it is, I'm going to make that.
I agree. That's exactly what I would do. You want to disguise your hand, right? You can't be making different size bets.
Exactly.
Even though it's jacks, and it's going to either break our heart or win us a lot of money, right?
Right.
Usually break our hearts.
Yeah, there's no good way to play jacks.
Like, almost all the time, break our hearts.
Yeah, they always lose.
All right. He says, my standard raise is usually 11 in this game, to the point that several players started calling that raise the Bloomberg. So I do that. All right. So exactly what we said. Standard raise
11. We make it 11. Okay.
Yeah. All right. I get one caller, the villain, which from the previous hands he sat in, which of course we don't even remember now, as well. but he's in the hijack, has not had a good start to the night, as he's at 120 down from his original 200. He's been complaining already about getting good starting hands and not hitting, but that kind of complaining is pretty normal in this game.
All right.
Yeah, makes sense. A bunch of old guys around bitching about the card check.
All right, so we're heads up. We got about 23-24 bucks in the pot.
And out of position, and the flop is the four of hearts, nine of diamonds, seven of clubs.
Nice. That's a great flop.
Beautiful flop, right?
Rainbow, no real straight draws. And unless this guy's got queens or better or set, we're golden, so we're going to feel comfortable betting here. Well, I would say there's about 23 or 4 in the pot. I wouldn't mind betting, say, 18, 16, something like that.
That's exactly what he bet, 18. Look at that.
Yes.
Guys are sharing a survivor brain.
I'm on Fiverr.
He says, I lead for 18. Again, my fairly standard continuation bet. And our opponent calls.
Hmm.
So our hero feels like he's certainly ahead here.
Maybe he's got something like eights or... He's starting to narrow the range down now, you know? Something where he was calling to hit a set, didn't really hit his set, and now he's got something... It's possible. Could have two overs, too, but that's a lot of money to call for just two overs, I would think. I don't...
Yeah, I haven't quite eliminated a suited 5-6 from the range.
Okay.
Some
okay.
People like will make that kind of call, and that's open-ended at this
and
point.
And in position, too. Yeah.
Probably
okay.
Unlikely. But, yeah. You know, I'm all keeping right. That in the back of my mind as a possibility.
So we're thinking medium pairs, maybe two overs if you're loose like Scott is, and then suited connectors that might fit right in there and give you a straight draw.
Yeah, the problem with the two overs here is that you really got to, like, race to figure out where you are, don't you?
I don't know.
You got, like, ace-queen here, and you just call.
Well, if you're floating, you're floating now, because you don't think he really has something, and you steal on the turn. That's the plan there.
Okay. Well, that's the plan. That's the difference.
Yeah, you're floating, and you could hit one of your cards to be good, too. So if you have something like ace-queen, ace-king, you know, at this point it could be ace-jack or something like that. You know, if you hit your turn card, you think you're good because your pair is higher than the three that are on the board now. You might be good.
Okay.
And you're floating. Right. If he checks his ace-king to you, if you think he has ace-king, now you're floating him and you're stealing it from him on the turn. If you hit, so you don't have to hit your card. So.
All right.
Lots of reasons to have that hand.
Made sense. All right. The turn is the deuce of hearts. So our board now is four of hearts, nine of diamonds, seven of clubs. Deuce of hearts probably doesn't change a thing. And he says, as Norman Shad says, a deuce on the turn never changes anything.
Let's see. All right, so there's two hearts on board now, so we got to try to protect against that as well, in case somehow he had, what did you say before? 5-6? What if he had 5-6 of hearts?
5-6, yeah.
Exactly. So we know he's probably not going to fold anyway, but we got to bet take this down now before he does hit his over. In case he is floating, we don't want to give him the control of the hand now. We want to make sure he knows, hey, I can't float this guy, and I bet it. So we got to make some sort of bet. There's a decent amount of money out there now. There's a 36 plus the original 24, so, you know, that's 60 bucks. I got to bet a decent amount here. I got to bet, like, 40 bucks here, I think, 35, 40. There's a lot of money out there now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I got to ratchet it up a little bit now. So.
Yeah.
Our hero says, I still believe I'm ahead, and I bet 22 bucks, and then immediately believe it's too small.
You are correct.
That is not
enough. Yeah, that is not enough. I mean, now, by just calling, I mean, even if he has, he could still have two overs. He still could be floating you, but he could have, if he was floating you, he probably would have raised that bet. I think. He might have raised that bet. So he might be drawing now. You know, he might have something might have, he might have hearts. He might have something like Jack 10 of hearts, and he had a gun before.
You could go back to what you're talking about, Ace Queen or something, and just thinking, hey, $22. I don't think it's worth $22 to hit my ace here in this hand.
Yeah.
Or my queen, for that matter.
Not enough money. That was definitely not enough. No, any hand now could make that call, really, that he was calling with on the flop. Yeah. So
now the problem is there's so many cards I don't want to see now.
Yeah.
The way that he's just been calling behind us.
Yep.
All right, the river is the five of hearts, so our final board is four of hearts, nine of diamonds, seven of clubs, deuce of hearts, five of hearts, so both hearts and straights get there. And he reminds us that the villain has $69 left.
That's like the worst card ever, because it makes our hand feel strong, but it completes everything. You know what I mean? It's just crazy. And if 6-8 was out there, which is a likely holding, two hearts, anything. Even something like ace three of hearts now has made a steel wheel.
Right, yeah.
You know? But again, I don't know if ace three sticks around unless he was floating. Just to steal, it didn't matter what his cards were. So it's possible. There's a lot of hands that can beat us now. That right now we really only have a hand that beats a bluff or tens or something like that. And even that's a bluff, essentially, because what can that hand beat except a bluff? So, oh, jeez. But if you check, he can steal it for $70.
Only if you let him steal it. I guess that's what I'm thinking right now. I mean, I'm looking at this from the point of view that there's a better than 50-50 chance that I have this hand won, I think. Uh-huh. There's a lot of danger, obviously, so I'm not excited about putting more in. But the fact that he only has 69 left, I think I might be able to make that call. And again, I go back to kind of my strategy, and it may not be a right strategy, but, you know, I'm up $210 for the game so far, right?
Uh-huh.
So I've got some extra ammunition to play with, and I don't want to be reckless with it, but this isn't a situation where I think I'm being reckless, and there's a very good chance that my hand's the best here. So if I check in, the worst he can do is put in $69, and I think I'm comfortable making that call, and hopefully if I check, he puts in a smaller bet, even better. It'd be a different story if he has covered here and can really put a hurt on us and steal it. But I don't think, I really don't, and for me, he can't steal his hand from me.
Because 69 is not enough to make you fold?
It's not enough for me to make me fold, I don't think.
Okay.
So, with that being said, I think I'm just going to check and hope I get the showdown cheaply if I'm behind and willing to give up some value if I'm ahead.
Well, if there's no hand, no bet that can make you fold at all, then there's no move that's a mistake. Unless there is value you could have gotten out of him that if he's checking.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the flip side of what I'm saying is if I'm willing to call a 69, why not put a bet in anyhow, maybe get him to call with a lesser hand.
Right.
And pick up some value. If
so
I'm just going to call
like
anyhow.
A defensive. Well,
if I bet 30 and he raises 69, that's another 39 I'm going to call, right? So, right. I mean, I guess my argument is, again, it's probably 50-50. I think it's more than 50-50. It's probably 60-40 that we got this hand won, I think. So,
okay.
At that point, if I can just not put a bet in and have him check behind and take it down, that'd be great. But
so you're saying put in a bet because no way you're folding, but you might get value out of it. And if he shoves, you were going to call anyway, no matter what he did. So put in something where you think he can call if he's made, say, you know, I don't know, a pair of nines or something, where he has eights or tens that he thinks are good. And then
that is true. I mean, what if he had like ace nine or something?
Right.
I mean, he's gonna call here, right? Probably.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he would have played it the way he played it if he had ace nine. He probably would have made a raise somewhere in there to see where he was, but to protect it too.
Yeah.
I agree, though. I mean, if he had something, even if he had something like tens or eights, where he didn't think, because eights is still pretty good here.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah. So maybe put in a value bet of like 25 or something like that, or 20 or something, just to see, because you bet 22 on the last street. So maybe now you bet 20 again, thinking, oh, I'm still kind of silly with my betting. You know, and then he calls it because he's got eights. And if he shoves, you know you're going to call anyway because it's only 49 more if you bet 20. If you bet 25, it's only whatever. So, yeah, I like a bet here. If you know you couldn't fold for 69, I like a bet here. If you could fold for 69, I still kind of like a bet here. And then if you, I don't know. I don't know what the deal is. I think no matter what, you're probably not folding no matter what he bets. So maybe you can't steal it. I don't know. 70 seems like kind of steep, but we haven't overpaired his whole board, and I don't know. I mean, he could have hearts, and we're screwed no matter what we bet or do. But other than that, I agree with you.
Worst case at the end of this hand, that we're still 90 up to the night.
I agree with you.
All right, so Arthur says, I still feel like I'm ahead, but I don't know for sure. I can't see how he gets to the river with the flush. and I just don't put him on two pair or a set based on the way the hand is played, though I know it's possible. As I think, as I discussed my previous hands against this villain, I know if I check, he'll see the sign of weakness and he'll shove. Rather than putting the decision on me, I decided to put one on him. I bet $35 with a plan to call if he shoves. He shoves and I call.
All right, well, wait, just one thing I want to say is...
Yeah, I'm going to say something here, too. Okay, probably the same thing you want to say.
The hearts. He said, I don't see how River Flush gets there, and you and I both...
Yeah, there is a way for that.
We found a way easily for that to be. He could have been floating with two hearts and then just happened to pick up the draw and then wasn't going anywhere for your cheap bet. So that's how I see the hearts getting there. But again, you and I talked about that's one hand out of a bunch of hands that, you know, we beat and a bunch of hands that beat us. So we couldn't fold for that amount. Now that you put 35 out there, you definitely can't fold for, you know, right. 34 more. So
I think the telling thing about it he just mentioned is, I know if I check, he'll see it as a sign of weakness and he'll shove. I mean, that's exactly what I want. If I know that he's going to shove as a sign of weakness, great. Yeah. I got a good hand, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, my concern is, you know, checking behind, having him check behind and with the hand that he would call and losing that value. But if he's saying right now, if I check, he's going to shove as a sign of weakness, I'll take that all day long.
Yeah, yeah. But again,
it doesn't matter. It's the same result. You know, we got all the money
in.
We
just hope it's good.
Yeah. All right. Our opponent turns over to the Ace of Hearts, King of Hearts.
That's exactly what we were talking about. We even said two overs. We said two hearts. It all fit together. That's like a beautiful hand. So, all right, let's revisit it real quick. I know he probably has some stuff he wants to say, but we'll revisit it real quick. So he just calls the raise instead of re-raising pre-flop, which is okay because he's in position.
Yeah, that's how I would play it.
The flop is nothing, but we have two overs. We don't believe Bloomberg. We can float him with ace-king. We got two overs and a backdoor heart draw.
Mm-hmm.
So we call the 18 to float him. And then on the turn, we pick up the flush draw. We still have two overs on top of it. Nut flush draw and two overs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way that 22 is going to make us. Even if you bet 40, we're probably not going anywhere now.
Right, exactly.
And I don't really see a reason to raise, because then if he shoves on you for your entire stack, I mean, I guess you can get it all in, but do you want to get it all in with one card to come? Probably not. So you just call and hope you hit it. And if you hit one of your high cards or you hit your flush, you're golden probably. So
yeah,
absolutely.
I think the problem, normally I would probably raise there just because I don't want to not hit my hand and not win. And if you raise on that turn, you have a chance of taking it down there. The problem with it is that deuce of hearts, as he said, Norman Chad said, doesn't change anything. So at that point, what do you...
Yeah, if you're making
it's a tough story to sell. Now you're kind of like trying to, you know, represent a set or something that's a little bit scared now, which I guess might work, but...
Yeah, because even so, if our guy, Bloomberg, isn't going anywhere in this hand, so... You don't know that by you reopening their betting, he could have been betting that 22 because he's paying for you to call with his set. You know, he could have a set of nines there, and he's just begging you to call that $22 since you came along. So now you make it 60, and he shoves his whole 410 in there or whatever he has left over. Now you're like, oh, do I really want to put 70 more in here now and hope I hit my hand on one card? Do I get away from it? Because it's easy to bet 70 on the river when you got your nut flush, but when you have one card left and you're looking at 70 and you started with only 100...
Right.
You're going to fold that. So you don't... I don't ever raise on the turn there like that. I want to just get my hand or steal it on the river if I can. You know, I think this guy played exactly the way a lot of people would play ace-king here. And two hearts, man. He picked up the flush draw on you and just happened to be that way. Sorry.
Yeah, our hero says, well, that's how he got there with the flush. After I half-jokingly berate him for calling on the flop with that hand, he says ace-king hasn't been hitting, so he decided to see where this one led him. He figured he had two over, so those were good. And when the second heart ended the turn, he was never going away, so my turn bet size, which I worried was too small, didn't actually matter. And good point. Then on the river, he just didn't have enough left for me to fold. This hand led to a downward spiral, during which I lost almost all the rest of my earlier winnings. Still not sure exactly how, but I cashed out a whopping $4 up. I hate it when a win feels like a loss.
Ah, but you know, it's priceless to be on our show, so. You earned that right, so there you go, buddy. But that's tough, and that happens a lot, too. All of a sudden, you're trying to get that money back, you're raising a little more, or whatever, and and this ends up happening. I don't know if we played it wrong at all. I mean, that $22 bet, which, if you take results out of it, probably isn't the right move to make there.
I think probably the only thing, again, and this is a result of already knowing what our opponent had now, is had we just checked the river.
I'm not convinced
that he would have shoved there, right? Because he wants to get out of
it. Given what he said about him, he would have, but I don't know if he really would have.
Well, that's only if he's seeing as a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
Seeing a sign of weakness, you want to get a better hand to fold. I mean, he had the nuts.
Yeah.
He wanted value out of it.
Yeah.
So I think he would have probably bet $30 or something and would have saved yourself.
Yeah, you're right. He wouldn't have shoved. You're right. Like that's absolutely right.
But that's hard to say at this point. So.
You got it. All right. Well, thanks for the hand. Always good to hear from the bloom. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Locke.
See you at the table.
Anti-Up is a production of antiupmagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@antiupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.